are starting the Mystic Pete Chronicles, and I'm Mystic Pete. Every week, through interviews with thought leaders, visionaries, and creatives, and stories, music, and humor, we'll do some deep ponders in this time of great change and have some fun. If you'd like more information about today's guests or to be interviewed for the show yourself, I'm at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. In today's show, I interviewed two innovative artists doing very exciting work. The first interview is with Ashwini Ramaswamy. She has a show at the Broad Stage in Santa Monica on April 7th and 8th called Let the Crows Come. And later in the show, I interview Ari Grab, animator. Between the two interviews, I play some musical selections from Let the Crows Come and some other lovely Indian music. Stay tuned. Mystic Pete Chronicles. It's March 24th, 2023. Mystic Pete here with Ashwini Ramaswamy, who's performing at the Broad Stage in Santa Monica, April 7th and 8th. Her show is called Let the Crows Come. Tell us a little about your background, and then we'll get into the details about the show. Looks fantastic.
Thank you. Yes, absolutely. I am a dancer and choreographer based in Minneapolis, Minnesota. The style of dance that I practice is called Bharatanatyam. Bharatanatyam is from southern India, and I'm actually part of a company, a Bharatanatyam company that was founded by my mother, Rani Ramaswamy, in 1992. So we're in our 30th season here, and now is co-directed and also from a very early age directed by my sister, Aparna Ramaswamy. So we're sort of a family trio. I'm the youngest. And I am bringing this work, Let the Crows Come, which is one of the side projects I have been working on outside of the umbrella of Ragamala Dance Company, as a way to explore the way that I was born in the U.S. and am a multicultural artist who goes back to India very often and is, figuring out ways that I want to take my experience with being Indian and with the Bharatanatyam form into, with my own direction.
You have other artists on this show. Modern dance, African dance influences, and Gaga from the Gaga movement from Israel, not Lady Gaga.
Yes, the Gaga movement style came before Lady Gaga. I'll go back again to talking about a little bit about my history and with Ragamala Dance Company and my mother, Rani, who she really, when she founded our company in 1992, she was really interested in creating accessibility to this form, which, as I mentioned, is classical and it's over 2,000 years old. But I don't think a lot of people realize how resonant and contemporary it is. It has thrived over thousands of years because it is so rich and adaptable to the times, and because it grows with each of its practitioners. So she was really interested and excited to introduce this form to wide audiences. So she began collaborating with artists across genre back in the 90s and really developed an audience, because people would come to see her collaborators because they were unfamiliar with what she was doing. Then see Bharatanatyam and our specific lineage of Bharatanatyam, and we're very excited about it. So she really pioneered this collaborative spirit. And then when my sister became co-artistic director in the early 2000s, she was really interested in mining our own culture and taking from Indian traditions and really fleshing out the possibilities of that culture within Bharatanatyam. So the company really took on this depth of Indian philosophy and spirituality. So I kind of come out of both of those different perspectives. I basically, I grew up with dance as being a hobby instead of being what I thought was going to be my vocation in life, partially because I think I was pushing against an expectation. But after many years of trying, you know, I always danced, but trying a few other things, I realized that this was also my calling and my way of staying connected to India, my way of exploring, like I said, my multicultural background. So with this piece, I was interested in working with these two forms of dance. As you mentioned, Gaga, which has an Israeli form created in the 80s. And the other dancer she's highly trained. She went to Juilliard and she was trained in Graham technique, but she's also Trinidadian American and interested in African diasporic forms. So she has her own rich, unique tradition. And so I was really interested in working with dancers outside of Bharatanatyam while still keeping the rich traditions and the lineage that I come from. So this piece has all the forms, but in a way that they're in conversation with one another, they're informed by one another, but nobody performs another form. Everyone is really within their own traditions that they have been studying for decades.
Well, there's always this push and pull between novelty and tradition, and you may get some blowback from the purists, but here you're creating this whole new form, and I understand you're also influenced by DJ music that has influenced this production, like the way you're putting things together.
Yes, I think you're right about the idea of, you know, novelty and trying to create something that's just a fad rather than something that's deep. And so it's my hope with this project, because all the forms still stay true to themselves, that it will still make the purists happy. But yes, when you mention a DJ, the thinking behind that when I first was conceiving of the piece is that the idea that a DJ takes a piece of music and reworks it and remixes it, changing it, but maintaining its essence. And that's what I think of as being someone from multiple cultures, because you're constantly remixing yourself to be where you are in that moment, or code switching, as they call it. And so you're still you, but you're different from situation to situation. That was kind of the idea behind the DJ. So one of the composers in the work, he is an electronics musician who goes by DJ Rupture, but he's a composer. He's not he's not club spinning. He's creating new music using textures and ideas from around the world. So he was the first composer that I worked with for this piece. There's three different composers and three different kinds of music to go with each form that we will see on stage.
Amazing. I don't think people in the United States know a whole lot about classical Indian dance. I know a little bit because I'm a fan, but I know there's many, many forms from the different regions, and they're rather different. Can you speak a little bit about what's happening traditionally in India and where things are going now?
Basically, to kind of break it down, India has 5 or 6, depending on who you're talking to, classical dance forms. So from the various regions, these classical dance forms, they take on the traditions and cultures of that era, of that region. India is vast and is very, very diverse. I think people sometimes forget that it's like many countries in one. It's very, very diverse. And so the forms are different. They are based in different languages. They have taken on the cultures, as I said, of the different regions. So when you see them, they will be very different posture-wise, costume-wise, as I said, the language. And then, of course, they evolve within themselves. And today, Bharatanatyam, which is what I practice, I believe is the most popular of the classical styles, the most practiced. But people are experimenting here and in India with with the forms, because we're all changing. We're all, you know, much more interconnected than we ever have been before. The influences are vast. And so I think people are excited to take what they know and what they're experiencing and putting that into their dance. And that is how a dance evolves.
I don't think people realize in the United States that 100 years ago, there was no India. There was a bunch of different regions. And then it came together as a country. Well, let's talk about this show, Let the Crows Come. Crows actually are an important animal to me. You know, Mystic Pete, I'm into this whole kind of trans-dimensional stuff. Let the Crows Come uses crows as a metaphor, as messengers between the worlds. Please talk about that.
Absolutely. That's so funny. I've been doing fair amount of interviews because of this tour, and every different interviewer says, oh, they have their own relationship to the crow imagery. And so I have been finding that it actually resonates more than I even thought. But the very original thing, that the kernel of the idea, was because I read an article about crows and their many, many qualities that people don't realize. They are extremely intelligent. They can create tools out of sticks, and you know, many species of, they mate for life, or they recognize human faces. They're just things about them that I found interesting, rather than just the usual, you know, they're scavengers or they are bad omens or things like that. And so that just stuck with me. And then I was speaking with my mother about when our grandfather passed away, and there's these rituals that Hindus, especially one ritual called Pitru Paksha, it's called Fortnight of the Ancestors. And after someone passes on, there are 2 weeks of rituals, one of which is an offering of rice to the crow. And in that instance, the crow is thought to be a messenger from the departed soul. And when they come and take the rice, they are telling the people of Earth who are still alive that that soul has transcended. They are where they're supposed to be. Because in Hinduism, the death is not the end. It is the beginning. It's a new beginning, which is a wonderful way to think about passing from one world to the next. And so I loved that idea of being connected to my ancestor through the crows. So instead of thinking of the crow as a bad omen, we would think of it as a messenger from a loved one. So let the crows come, let our ancestors inform us and help us into the future.
So even in India, the crows are related to death, because here they're very closely connected with the Edgar Allan Poe's The Raven and so forth. So this is what the bird is.
Exactly. But because, as I said, because death is not the end and it's not considered bad in Hinduism, that messenger is not morbid, or it's hopeful.
I see. And what about your own spirituality? Sounds like you're pretty plugged in.
Bharatanatyam is a spiritual art form. It was born in the temples of India, of South India, as a way to communicate Hindu stories through the body of the dancer. So, you know, even if you aren't religious, you cannot remove, at least in our form and this lineage, the spirituality of the tradition. If you think of yourself as a medium of communication, it just charges your performance. It makes it so meaningful. And if you think about yourself and all the lineage of dancers that have come before you to get you to where you are today, it's very moving. And that really, I feel, is a great inspiration to keep dancing.
There's something very dreamlike about this production. Do you connect with the dream world yourself?
I think that there is a connection between dream, reality, past, present, future, all these things that we've tried to define that are indefinable. And in this piece, what you'll see is it's three solos that are interconnected by trios. And they're all the same piece repeated over and over by the three different dancers. The idea, starting with my Bharatanatyam solo, which was then carefully reworked on the other dancers to be part of their style. And the idea is a shared memory that is then remembered differently from person to person. And that's kind of this idea of body memory or this idea of ancestral memory. I mean, sometimes these things will come in a dream or something will happen to you that feels otherworldly and you can't explain it. And there has to be a reason for that. And, you know, you don't have to know that reason.
So this piece is really about connecting up the different realities, the dream world, the world we go to after we die, and art and music, and a little bit of DJ culture in there, poetry, sacred text. There's a lot happening here.
Yes, there's a lot of influences. That it's been highly researched and crafted in a way that hopefully is not overwhelming, but there are a lot of elements. And they, when you see the piece unfold, though, it is actually has a lot of simplicity to the way that it unfolds.
I see. Yes, that's the art of it. And that's what you've done. You've translated all these abstract concepts into something that's accessible to people.
I hope so.
Audiences in Los Angeles at the Broad Stage. So that's April 7th and 8th.
I'll just finish by talking quickly about the music. The three scores, if you will, are also traverse from the Carnatic, which is the South Indian classical musical score, to the electroacoustic cello, which is the score that is danced by the modern or African diasporic dancer, and the electronic score, which is danced by the Gaga dancer. And they're all informed by the Carnatic piece, but they don't sound like they are. So you get this, the whole piece is kind of this transference of ideas and knowledge and culture in a very organic way that I think you feel wash over you as you're watching it instead of being kind of hit over the head with the message. But to build each solo, it's just one solo, not just, but it is one solo that was created and then transferred. But to build a solo like that, you need narrative material. You can't just say it's about crows, right? So what I've done is I've taken poetry from South India, ancient poetry that predates religion. It's from a time when the land and the environment was the deity, you know, when people prayed to nature. And so there are these poems called Tamil Sangam poems, and they have different landscapes and they talk about the different, they can be very specific, and you can take from that what you will. And there's a few poems that mention crows, and the crows in those instances are also good omens. So for example, in the seaside landscape, all of the fishermen have gone out, and the town is waiting for them to return, because their return means not only are the people coming back, but it's abundance of the catch. And the crow flies to the mast of a ship and is watching for these people to come back. And when the crow flies back, it means they're coming. So that is this other way of talking about the crow as a symbol of hope. And then there are, you'll like this. In the trio section, I've taken a text. So in Hinduism and in India, people are very astrologically inclined. They believe in astrology. And the what I find fascinating are these texts. They talk about predicting the future based mainly on environmental forces, to the point where, like, one of them will be talking about the direction that a dewdrop falls from a leaf will predict something. And so I think they're really attuned, again, to nature and how much nature affects us in a way that I think people today are not as understanding about. So there's a text about the flight patterns of crows, and then if they fly in certain directions, they predict certain futures. So in these trio sections, there's a soloist who dances the predictions. There's one dancer who shows the direction, and then the other dancer shows a corresponding element like water, fire, earth, flora, fauna, that kind of thing. So you'll see also that repeated. So I'm not sure how much I really can follow the astrology to that degree, but I know that there was a time when that was studied so carefully by people, and people were so attuned to what was happening, that I have to believe that they knew if certain things happened in nature, that yes, it was going to predict certain things. And I think we've really fallen out of touch of that. And so I love that the ancient cultures are able to have that natural spirituality for our surroundings.
So this piece was informed by some very ancient knowledge of nature, from the way crows fly to the way that dew drops off of a leaf. I love crows. They can actually be trained to talk like humans, like parrots or cockatiels or something like that. Very evolved vocal mechanism. I hike a lot, and sometimes I'll be cawing and calling out to them, but hiding myself, and then they'll come fly over to see who it is. And then when they finally see it's a human, they'll go like, oh, come on, leave me alone, and they'll fly off. But I have a long relationship with crows. I love them. I'm a cellist. I'm really into dance. I'm into Indian dance. Dream world. I mean, okay, this show is just made for me, so I can't wait to see you guys.
Well, great. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah.
March 18th, 2023, Mystic Pete here with Ari Grabb, G-R-A-B-B. Hi, Ari.
Hey, Pete.
I've known you for quite a while. We've collaborated on some projects. You are an animator and director and kind of visionary, up-and-coming visionary guy.
Oh, thanks. Shucks. Thank you.
Yeah, you know, I figured let's get you on radio. Let's get you interviewed on the way up while you're still taking my phone calls. You know, at some point I'm just going to get your secretary. So let's interview you while I can. I mean, you're obviously one of these kind of like hot emerging talents, a lot of new ideas, and you have this new series out called Bento Banana.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a new episode. The series has been around for about 5 years, but yeah, by the time this is out, I think it will have just been released, a fourth episode of Bento Banana.
Bento Banana.
Yes.
And now you're kind of shopping it around, taking it to festivals and stuff?
Festivals, yeah. Shopping it? No. At least not actively. The project came about because I've been told no a lot for other ideas I've had. So this has been my kind of, I'm going to work on this when everyone else tells me that they don't want to do this other idea I have. It's my
passion project.
Yes, it's the passion project. It's what I go to get fuel when it's been beaten out of me by by the man.
So this is what happens with us artists. The world says no. The world rejects us. The world doesn't see our brilliance. And so we go back to our cave or back to the mountain, and we keep creating. We find a stronger vision. We sharpen our skills. And we get so good, the world cannot ignore us. But, I mean, this is like a strong project you're emerging with. We'll talk about it in a second. Let's just talk about your background for a second. I guess you've worked with Netflix and worked on Final Space.
Yeah, yeah. That was maybe like the best show I've worked on, Final Space. You know that one?
Conan.
Yeah, that's right. He produced it. It was such a beautiful looking show and a really smoothly run production. I wish it wasn't canceled, but that's the biz.
I loved Final Space. Oh. I love Conan.
Oh.
And I loved what you guys came up with. It was so brilliant and kind of heartfelt and gentle and absurdist and wild and scary. It was like it was a beautiful piece.
Yeah. Thank you. I mean, it's not my project, but thank you for saying that, because I mean, I worked on it, but also I feel like a lot of people brushed it off as like a silly sitcom with, you know, some sci-fi in it, when it was a genuine space opera with some comedy in it.
Mooncake. Yeah, Mooncake. And I could hear Conan's voice in there, you know, and it really, I'm such a fan of his. Well, what did you do on that show?
I was a retake animator, which means, so everything is very digital right now, right? And I'm gonna break things down very simply in case you or anyone who might be listening like doesn't know some basic animation pipeline principles, which is common.
Teach me.
So everything's really digital now, and we usually work in a software called Toon Boom Harmony when we're doing two-dimensional animation. And if you look closely at a lot of modern animated shows, not all of them, but a lot of them, you'll notice that the characters are actually puppets. They're digital puppets sort of being moved around. And to give some examples, Rick and Morty is one that I've told animation professors that it's rigged, and they were surprised, even. If you look at their arms or legs or whatever is being animated, you might notice that there's not always a new drawing being added in. They're more like moving parts of a drawing, pivoting them like a puppet, or maybe swapping in other drawings. Like if they're moving their hands and changing their finger positions, they might be just... That might have to be redrawn because it's very intricate, but there's kind of much less drawing these days. So that's sort of a long breakdown of what 2D animation looks like now. So you ask what it...
Well, let me just interject, because so in the old days, the old Disney movies, these were cell animations.
Yeah.
So every single movement was a different cell on acetate or plastic.
Yeah.
And you would just move them along and click the camera. There may be a background plate or various levels of it.
Mm-hmm.
But every little thing you see is drawn out continuously. But in digital animation, if I understand you correctly, you are creating a character that can move in a number of different ways. And you're just telling the program, move arm up, move arm down, walk. In other words, you've already created the range of movements it can make, and you're just telling a program now, move like this, with some additional little animation on top for very detailed work.
Yeah, that's pretty accurate. Usually, you know, you do have to apply principles and theory on your own to sort of really like give it that polish and love. Because if you just say, move the arm from this position to this position, just like that, very literally, it looks stiff and robotic.
Okay.
You know, there's all kinds of principles like easing, arcs, anticipation. There's all kinds of things you need to apply as well to make these things look human.
So you can tell the computer, like, walk, but then you kind of have to come in.
I could not tell the computer walk. That's a very intricate...
So even something like that isn't really automated. Like you can't tell a computer, move arm up, but then you have to go back and make it more human-like or more real-life-like.
Usually, yeah. It depends on how much time I have that day.
I get it. I see. So there's budgets. Yeah.
And I work in TV, so, you know, if on a film, you know, someone might have a week to work on, like, 2 seconds, whereas I've got to get like 20 shots done maybe in a week. It all varies.
So television is much quicker turnaround.
Yes.
Lower budgets.
Yes.
Just get the thing done. So
is it lower budgets? I don't know about that.
But
that might vary.
There's an emphasis on getting it completed.
Yeah.
Because there's a time frame that has to be met. There's a new episode that has to air. Maybe you can't put the real detail you would into a well-financed movie.
Yeah, and there's a term in animation we use a lot for a lot of these more popular shows, these animated sitcoms called talking head shows, where it's just characters standing in three-quarter positions, going from like pose to pose, kind of stiffly, and it's just about the dialogue. It's just about the context and not the movement or the sensory or the acting. You know what I mean?
And then you get the things like South Park, which are just things blocked out in very crude animation.
South Park is its own very unique brand of anime. I mean, they do everything in a week, and for a week, it actually looks incredible.
But it's all blocky, and...
Certainly old South Park was. I don't know if you've seen newer South Park, but it's actually... I mean... They do keep a lot of the, like, you're right, like, they move, like, just, like, bobbing up and down.
Yeah.
I guess I'm just so used to it now, I don't even think of it as, like, crude. I'm just like, that's how they walk in South Park.
Got it.
You're right. Yeah, they do have some stylistic limitations.
It's very confined.
Well, so back to what you do, what you did on Final Space.
Yes. So most animation now, for money reasons, is done overseas in other countries. And in the case of Final Space, it was animated at a studio called, was it Jamfield? It's Jam something. They're in Canada. And so they did the animation. They sent it back to the States, to the studio Shadow Machine. And from there, the post-production team, which consists of retake animators and compositors and editors, the retake animators sort of go in and touch up and change and refine the animation, because it's all with data now. It's all like digital parts that could be modified. So if the creator is like, you know, this acting's actually not right, or could we actually change the color of this, or can we plus up that punch, make it a little punchier, that's the retake animators team. Usually they handle more creative notes, sometimes technical as well.
You really polish it up so it looks great.
That's
the basics are handled overseas, whether it's Korea, Canada, Philippines.
You know, it depends on what studio you're working with. There are some studios where I couldn't call them the basics. Sometimes they just turn in gold. Like on Final Space, what we got, I was like, oh my God. You know, so what we were doing wasn't, sometimes it was plussing up, but I feel like usually more it was just like a new idea or a change of an idea that we were implementing. Whereas other shows, we've gotten some real crud back. I don't even know if I can call what they did the basics in some cases. Sometimes I'm just like, you just put them in their key poses and called it a day. What's going on?
I see. Let's back up a couple of levels so people think of animation. Well, there's the character voices, somebody wrote the story, somebody is making the broad outlines of how the characters move and what the characters look like. Yeah. Now, all that stuff is done at many levels before any of this takes place. Like right. The overall look and concept.
Pre-production.
Okay. Yeah. And that's more like the directors and some of the key animators. And
key animators would come into production. If we're talking pre, I think we're talking about character design and backgrounds and writing and layout artists and prop designers.
What people think of as the story, but there's many levels then that have to be working out together and integrated so it looks like a nice, polished final product.
I think I see what you're saying. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. I'm glad one of us sees what I'm saying. How did you put together your team?
It's a skeleton team. But most of the people on it, I've just known from either work or their friends. Only a few people, I think, are like more strangers who I reached out to just because I was fans of them. But, you know, I can give some examples. The background artist was a friend from college who I just think makes amazing art, and I wanted to utilize him. The sound designer is my like best friend from college who I met in film school, and he's a sound designer by trade, and I have him do all my sound because he's better at it than me by like leagues. The two cleanup artists who I hired, first time using cleanup artists, so in a traditional animation phase, which I guess I have to explain that Bento Banana has both traditional and rigged animation. So for the traditional parts, I did all the rough animation. You know, I drew everything, but it's still scratchy and uncolored. And then I handed those shots out to cleanup artists to do all the final line work and color.
Okay, I get it.
Yeah.
And this is how an emerging talent does his stuff in Los Angeles. I mean, you've worked on some big shows, but now you're putting together your own project, I guess GoFundMe funded.
Mm-hmm.
And you know people from school or friends, and you just have to get the thing done and put it together. It's your vision, yeah. But you find people you can work with, and everybody's a little bit hungry and scrambling and struggling and helping each other. So yeah. At this level, there's a lot of community. And you come up with a new project, and hopefully it airs someday, or somebody pays you a lot of money to do a series.
The hope is I want to do one more. I want to do one big one. But to actually jump back and add a little bit to what you were saying about the networking aspect, or just the collaborative aspect, really. A couple of the people I hired are people who are maybe kind of younger. And my mindset was, okay, when I was their age, what kind of money was I making from freelance? What kind of gigs were they? Like, how was I being used and exploited back then? And how can I not do that and treat them better? So, not to pat myself on the back, but I very much tried to make my team's life as easy and as fun as I could, because it's a low budget passion project. Once I make it into work for any of us, it's lost all meaning.
I've been in that situation in many different facets of life where I've been taken advantage of or abused.
Yeah.
And every time I decide, okay, that's not what I'm going to do. You know, I'm going to, if there's any money in the project, I'm paying people well, at least value the, or, you know, musicians going to a gig, say it's a free gig, I'm at least paying them their gas money and buying them dinner. And mm-hmm. I can't tell you how many gigs I've played on myself where nobody gave me a penny. Mm. You know, just like something to say what you did is valuable.
Yeah.
So I appreciate your work habits.
I went as far as to send my crew all hoodies that I designed myself with some stickers and pins.
You know, yeah, just say something like, thank you. What you've done is beautiful, and yeah, you'll be there for them. Now, let's go to a little bit of where this piece fits in the animation oeuvre. I'm thinking of Ren and Stimpy, which came out in the 90s, and it kind of broke the mold. I think that's the word. I
want to give you a quick heads up if you don't know. The creator of that show was, like, hella canceled. Like, hella controversial.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you know this.
Well, okay. It was edgy. It was violent. There was sexual innuendos. A lot of shock value. But it started a whole new trend in animation, I think. And I think Beavis and Butthead kind of came out of that absurdist kind of counterculture, like, FU animation. And then I look at your piece, and it is absurdist. I mean, it has some of those same qualities from, like, Ren and Stimpy, but now, you know, exponentially accelerated. You're dealing with science fiction, and it's kind of all glitchy and abstract at times. It's edgy stuff you're doing. So, I mean, I'm just as a kind of a layperson, tracing it back to maybe when this started. But you explain.
Yeah. You know, I felt myself there just being really resistant to being compared to Ren and Stimpy because of the controversy of its creator. But I think it's unfair of me to do that, because that was an influence to me growing up. And I'm someone who doesn't fully believe in death of the artist, so it's conflicting. But I can speak a lot to what you're saying about counterculture, edgy animation, because, yeah, growing up, animation was just sort of, it was very polar. It was either the most childish thing or it was the most raunchy thing you could make as a way to respond to the childish animation. So I actually grew up with a lot of, like, pretty hard to watch now animation. A lot of stuff back then, me and my friends call it Gen X humor. It was mm-hmm. It was very like, hey, we fixed the world, and so now the truest expression we can do is be as offensive as possible.
That's what it was. Yeah. It was this rebellion against, you know, strawberry cheesecake or whatever the heck this silly stuff was.
Yeah.
And then even in SpongeBob SquarePants, you see a lot of absurdism, grotesque close-ups.
Yeah.
And, I mean, this is as pop TV as you can get, but you can trace it back to the time when somebody in animation, you know, stuck up their middle finger. That is in SpongeBob, as far as I can tell. And now you're going even further, where it's meta, in other words, it's self-referential.
Yeah.
These characters, Bento Banana and his sidekick Plumpy.
Yes.
By the way, you call it like every anime, but better.
Yeah, so you're hitting the nail on the head. Like, Bento does feel like a middle finger, because when I started it, that is very much where I was. I was very much frustrated with what was going on around that time. I mean, you know, I could talk about the surface level things of, you know, the industry not treating me the way I dreamed it would when I was younger and all this stuff, but also, like, I had a lot of unresolved trauma back then. And I think you look at a lot of artists' work, that's, you know, you can see some repressed adolescence in there, and by God, there's a lot of that in Bento. And there's, you know, there's some unprocessed work, and I've been working on it now, which is great. And I'm working on projects now that feel a lot more mature, but Bento still must carry this repressed adolescence. There's a spirit in there that needs to feel like a middle finger that also loves you.
Yeah, there is a heart to it. But as I was saying, there's a lot of meta, self-referential.
Yes, I like meta humor.
Parts, yes. you're speculating on the nature of being, ontology, time.
Oh, and good, you picked up on that.
Indeed. And here these are characters in a regular anime, but somehow not following their intended route.
Yes.
There's like something
that's back to what we're talking about.
Something's going wrong here in this anime. That was very creative. Thank
you. You know, if I had my big old business hat on and my suitcase and tie, and I was talking to you about, you know, its intended demographics, I would say something about, like, millennials and Gen Zers who like geek culture and anime. But secretly, I really want a more, like, how would I put it, tantric community to be interested in it.
Oh, you're going new age on us? Uh-oh.
I mean, I think it's already there.
I'm trying to escape.
Yeah, I'm just diving right in. No, I mean, there are, it's not like I intended to, but after this latest episode, looking back while I was making it, I was like, oh my God, there's so many themes about non-duality and IFS and all this stuff I'm into kind of going on, and I love that.
Well, not to get too high flown, but a lot of the answers to the chaos in society comes from artists, or artists who are frustrated and are breaking free and just coming up with new innovative ideas, perhaps totally random or absurdist, and that helps us to start thinking in new ways and to seeing answers where there were none. Lord knows we're in an extremely chaotic time, and a lot of people feel like they're at a dead end and society's at a dead end. But yeah. What do we just lose? Is this Armageddon? Is this the end of our species? No, there's what's the future? And sometimes the future is found by breaking pattern, breaking what we think we know. Anyway, you're actually doing that in a little anime that's a few minutes long. You're questioning premises of reality.
Everything you just talked about is kind of, those are the questions I want to focus on for the next and last Bento. Sort of the role of, like, what is animation's role when it looks like it's the end of the world? Because, when I finished Bento 4, I kind of realized that it's a very chaotic cartoon, and I think a lot of that chaos, not all of it, but a lot of it was just residual pain from the pandemic. Like, that's how it felt. It was confusing, and it was weird, and it was scary, and it was loud. It was just, it was a tough time, and that cartoon was kind of my, like, spiritual diarrhea of that moment.
Yeah, right. And that's what it is sometimes, you know, the artistic process, it's a vomiting out.
Yeah.
It's just throwing some crap against the wall, which ends up a lot of people look at and go,
What is this here? This is new. This is interesting.
Yeah, my
punk rock.
My therapist describes art as a process. It's just a process, which I like because, you know, here comes my repressed adolescence again. But it makes me compare the process of making art to taking a poop, which just makes me not make it too special. I just continuously am like, don't get hung up on how special your poop is. It's just a process.
Okay, you just let it come out. Don't judge it. Just blast it out.
But I fail at it. I obsess over it. I try and meditate, and I just think about this special little cartoon I'm trying to make.
Very cool. Well, I wanted to, as I say, kind of catch you on the way up, because one thing I'm sure of, and come back in 10 years and Ari Grab is going to be making a lot of waves in the entertainment and art community.
Thank you.
And name of the animation is Bento Banana.
Yeah, it's on my YouTube page, which is just my name, Ari Grab.
G-R-A-B-B.
Two Bs.
Thanks, brother.
Thank you.
We are coming to the end of the Mystic Pete Chronicles. You can reach me at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. In today's show, I interviewed Ashwini Ramaswamy. She'll be at the Broad Stage April 7th and 8th. Broadstage.org for more information there. Her show is called Let the Crows Come. Right after the interview, some musical selections from Let the Crows Come. Right after that, well, I'm going to let my friend Anshul tell you the names of those tunes so I don't ruin it with my white boy pronunciation.
We heard Kirtanam, Karanam Karanam, Rag Shurashtram using Tal Mishra Kappu by Vijayanti Mala, composed by Gopal Krishna Bharti from Bharatanatyam Volume 2 Classical Dance Music. And then we heard Mangalam Rag Vasanta using Tal Aadi, also by Vijayanti Mala, composed by Muthuswami Dixitar from Bharatanatyam Volume 2 Classical Dance Music.
Thank you, Anshul. And we just finished with my interview with Ari Grab with two Bs. Thanks, Ari. We'll be back next week with the best of talk radio. Mystic Pete out!